Hello, this is a show from Radio. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners.
Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond.
Delta 2 Yankee, Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Are you up for it?
Designs for speech scramblers go back to 1881, and the desire to make telephone and radio communications unintelligible to third parties has been with us ever since. The message is scrambled in transmission and then unscrambled at the other end. There are many of these speech scrambling devices that work on different principles. In another device, the signal is choosing their minds when they find that what they see and hear in the street has personal meaning for them. Some time ago, a young man came to me and said he was going mad because street signs, overheard conversations, and radio broadcasts seemed to refer to him in some way. I told him, of course they refer to you. You see and hear them.
Hi, my name's Damon Baker. I'm a professor at New York City College of Technology in New York City. I'm engaged in a project that's been going on for a while, but I really kicked off this year. I've been doing a lot of research and writing and work about William S. Burroughs. He's the famous novelist. He'd be 100 years old if he wasn't dead. I guess he's still 100 years old, but he is dead. And so it's his centennial. So William S. Burroughs, Brian Geisen, and particularly Ian Somerville, who he mentions kind of in passing, but was the one who actually provided a lot of the technical know-how, particularly the access to the recorders and things like that, had started examining how technology and media could manipulate texts and words and ideas and be able to play with our associations with them. And then they started expanding outward to, instead of one person sitting there with a tape machine editing things around and making some sort of strange story, what if we use these machines to broadcast, to reach out to large numbers of people? Could we manipulate or input ideas out into the public? What effects can we have on things? And those are really the ideas that get covered in the two essays that I've been looking at a lot, which is The Invisible Generation and then The Electronic Revolutions. They lay out a lot of ideas, mostly in terms of tape recorders, but they're really focused on things like dozens of people carrying portable tape recorders around or getting access to broadcasting equipment. So it's about transmission, carrying ideas around, and he really uses a lot of disease terminology throughout his talk about transmission, like transmitting of disease. That's why the transmission as contagion in both the medical sense and in kind of the anthropological primitive magic theory of contagion kind of ideas. Burroughs happily moves back and forth between those kinds of frames of reference with no qualms or problems whatsoever.
Your tape recorder, a tracking station for paranormal voices, ? It seems that recordings made with no apparent input have turned up unexplained voices on the tape. I'm quoting from the book of Voice phenomena are done with a tape recorder and microphone set up in the usual way and using factory fresh tape. No sounds are heard or emitted during the recording, but on replay, faint voices of unknown origin appear to have been recorded. Visible speech diagrams and voice prints have confirmed that these actually are recorded voices. And the most complete source book is a book called Breakthrough by Constantine Rowdy. That's actually pronounced Rowdy Vey. It's Latin. Published in 1971 by the Taplinger Publishing Company in New York City. Well, Rowdy was one of the pioneer researchers in this area, and he has recorded 100,000 phrases, selections from which are transcribed in his book. And other investigators have obtained similar results, including Dr. Walter H. Uphoff who teaches parapsychology at the University of Colorado here in Boulder. I've been trying to contact him, but haven't been able to reach him yet. And these voices do seem an appropriate topic to take up at the Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. Before discussing the experiments carried out by Rowdy, I will describe experiments performed with Brian Geisen and Ian Somerville 12 years before Breakthrough was published, and in fact before it was written. Now, these experiments started not on tape recorders, but on paper. In 1959, Brian Geisen said that writing is 50 years behind painting, and applied the montage technique to words on a page. And this technique had already been used in painting at that time for 50 years. It was, in fact, kind of old hat in painting. Brian copied out phrases from newspapers and magazines, then took a scissors and cut these selections into pieces and rearranged the fragments at random.
I'm Tom Rowe from Wave Farm in upstate New York, where we are cutting up William Burroughs' talks and sounds today, trying to find a link between outer body radio and inner body transmissions, whether they be from animals or humans, in William Burroughs' work. We've heard from Damon Baker and his talk on William Burroughs on Wave Farm Radio, and we will hear from Anna Fritz, radio artist, who will make a whale radio link to Burroughs later with our inner body transmissions. We'll also hear from Gilligan's Island in the 60s and others who claim to have radio reception in their teeth.
You young squirts couldn't lance a pimple without an electric vibrating scalpel with automatic drain and suture. Soon we'll be operating by remote control on patients we never see. We'll be nothing but button pushers. All the skill is going out of surgery. All the know-how and make-do.
One of the most bizarre urban myths of all comes from wartime USA and involves America's queen of comedy, Lucille Ball.
I had some dental work to be done. You know, they put in temporary fillings. I was just driving along and a road that I'd taken many times. And all of a sudden, I heard music. But I mean, with a great beat, you know. And I looked down to turn off my radio, and it wasn't on. And the music was getting louder and louder and louder, and I realized it was in my mouth. And it was beating in my ears. I could hear the tune and everything. I recognized the tune.
The following morning at work, comedy legend Buster Keaton offered this explanation for the ghostly tune.
And he said, what street were you on, Moore Park? And I said, yes. He said, you went by the radio station. You picked it up. Well, you got any fillings? I said, yes. He said, you picked it up in your teeth. Well, I could hardly wait to go by there again.
I'm sorry, little buddy. It was strictly an accident. I didn't hurt you too bad, did I? You try moving your jaw back and forth. Good. Now try opening your mouth. Professor, I don't see how a smack in the jaw could turn him into a radio.
Well, he's not a radio skipper. He's merely a simple form of receiver. You see, the high-frequency sound waves are emanating from the molar, which is pushed against...
Never mind all the technicalities, Professor. The thing I'm getting at is I've been belted many times before, but the only thing that ever came out of my mouth was a loose tooth.
From what I've been able to see, one of Gilligan's molars has been jolted out of position and shoved against a tooth with a silver filling. Open, Gilligan.
This is station KALU, Honolulu, the voice of pineapple.
Close. Not too unusual a situation. It's happened a number of times.
Yes, but not to Gilligan.
Well, the atmospheric conditions, the metal in his mouth, the shape of his skull have all combined to make him a receiver.
Is there any chance, Professor, instead of being a receiver, could we make him a sender so we could get a message to Hawaii?
No, I'm afraid not, Skipper. And unless I miss my guess, the position of his head and his body will bring in different stations. Watch. Open up, Gilligan.
Solid steel shower, man.
They're gambling taxes.
Well, I'll be darned.
Gilligan, your tooth may go back into position by itself, or perhaps I'll have to find a non-conductive substance to coat it with. Or maybe I'll pull the tooth. Well, you make the decision. You are going to have to stay away from this transistor radio, Gilligan. The signals you're emitting are loud enough to cause interference.
There must be a way I can make money from that boy's teeth. This could be bigger than transistor radio. Molar FM. By Cuthbert Shortwave.
Two of his teeth jammed against each other. It's as simple as that.
Yes, and it's all because I accidentally belted him one.
That's right, and when he hit the table, it jammed it back into his normal position.
Is clearly working as it slides down the back of my throat and heads towards my stomach.
It's very funny.
something into the stomach. Here it goes.
Ooh, there it goes.
Down here, it's a cavernous, alien landscape.
That someone was communicated by humans on the tape and asserted to some other force?
They don't know. I'll consider the various theories for the origin of the voices in the next lecture. But there's been no complete explanation. The simple fact is, here he has recorded in a soundproof studio, no input, and there are voices on the tape. That's the basic fact which has been proven, that they are voices and that they are there. Yeah.
So from that, is one conclusion that the voices are there and you need soundproof room in order to hear them? There's no other input.
Not
when they're running those tapes, no other input?
There's no other input on his procedure because he was interested in proving his case under test conditions. However, a soundproof studio is not at all essential. And the first voices were someone who's recording bird songs.
And then heard humans.
So RFID tags have been used some time for implanting in animals, for example, to identify them. If they go missing, you can scan them, get a number, and cross-reference that with a database. But this technology has really developed over the last 5 or 10 years. And really, now we should consider these devices to be more like little computers. They can store information, manipulate information, do simple computations. So when we're implanting this type of device, really we're implanting it like a miniature computer.
Now, you've actually got a chip implanted in your hand, haven't you?
Yeah, I have one in my hand. What that allows me to do is, for example, have secure access to the building. It allows me to use my mobile phone because it can recognize, the phone can recognize me via the chip, but no one else can use my phone. So these are fairly simple applications of this technology, but with these advances in technology come new risks.
And just show us what you've done to that chip.
Well, what I can do is actually read the contents of the device. This last part of all the information inside the device is actually a computer virus. So what this allows the chip to do is when it accesses a system, the system reads the contents and then gets infected by the virus. And then any other device using the system then becomes infected by the virus as well.
Now, you've given the chip a virus. Why should that matter?
As we look to the future, I think this sort of technology, implantable technologies, is actually going to become fairly commonplace. If we look at medical technologies, for example, heart pacemakers, this is a deep brain stimulator unit which is implanted in the chest and actually has electrodes that go into the center of the brain. If we look at these types of applications of implantable technology, there are benefits, but there are also risks associated with that.
So we're looking at a future where you could have some advanced medical device inside you, and that could be infected by some other chip inside you.
Yeah, that's right. That's quite possible.
I mean, who knows what will come of it? My guess is they'll probably have a GPS chip in there so that they can measure everybody, every instant, no matter where they go. So to me, it violates the whole principles of privacy, the principles of the Constitution, the principles of the Republic. And to me, it's a gross distortion of what we should be doing. It's part of an authoritarian society, and dictatorships have this, but not a republic.
What keeps mankind alive? You gentlemen who think you have a mission to purge us of the 7 deadly sins should first sort out the basic food position, then start your preaching. That's where it all begins.
So we heard from scholar David Baker, who's been studying William Burroughs' words, and we heard the 1960s American situation comedy television show Gilligan's Island, where radio reception was possible through teeth now radio artist Anna Fritz explores the current possibilities of whale radio and how whales have a utopian communication transmission system. Here's radio artist Anna Fritz talking at the TransX Transmission Art Symposium in Toronto about whale radio.
I want to talk a little bit about whale radio. Gregory Whitehead, radio artist, calls Captain Ahab of Moby Dick fame the first shock jock, as the scarred and hobbled lightning-struck captain rants his way through the pages of Moby Dick. Waving his harpoon at the stormy skies, filled with hate for the elusive whale, Ahab is struck by lightning, electrified, his peg leg tapping out a Morse code of vengeance across the deck. Ahab may be a forerunner to the big-mouthed, blasted broadcast radio hosts, who we will not name at this moment, but we can imagine who they are, or the material inside the spermaceti organ, which is on the big melon head of sperm whales. And it enables echolocation and sound-making in a sperm whale. So it's a gigantic organ filled with the spermaceti material. So here the whale spermaceti, the actual stuff which allows sperm whales to echolocate and communicate, becomes a medium for human communication. But what if the whale proposed an alternate understanding of transmission in its own society that is entirely missing from this account? So recent studies of toothed whales and dolphins, also known as odontocetes, pretty much all of the current whale research now discusses whales as having culture, as living in societies, as speaking languages and dialects. The brains of humpback whales, dolphins, orcas, sperm whales, and others are especially developed in areas of acoustic processing and communication intelligence. And researchers have been able to observe that they use very complex language, including very distinct dialects among different groups, even living in close proximity to one another. That they pass memories and knowledge on to subsequent generations through communal recollection. That they have self-consciousness, complex coalition formation skills, and have been known to use tools. Sound travels more than 4 times more quickly in water than in air, and water is a particularly excellent medium for long-range transmission of low-frequency sounds. As a result, the use of echolocation and acoustic communication among whales and dolphins holds some surprising parallels to the notions of resonant transmission that I've been discussing with regard to radio. Sperm whale researchers describe being in the water near a group of sperms and feeling the pulses in their bones as they are echolocated from close range by the whales. And so too, dolphin researchers, such as Kathleen Dudzinski and Tony Frohoff, they write, "When a dolphin turns toward you and explores you acoustically with echolocation, you may even feel the buzz of sound waves in your bones and muscles, as you reveal more detailed aspects of your physiology to the dolphin by sound waves, more information than the eyes can see." Kind of like a little ultrasound, almost. These researchers speculate that such intimacy among whales enable the tight social formations and more extensive group consciousness that cetaceans exhibit. While long-range echolocation and sound-making allows whales to have an acute spatial sense in their surroundings. Thus, whales would seem to use sonic communications in ways that are physically, socially, and geographically resonant. Says Peter Hoare, "It was as if they were resounding miles below, even as they radioed their presence to other whales miles apart. Tuned into some unseen circuit of food and communal intent, they knew instinctively where they were, while we wonder constantly what on earth we are doing." That's regarding those sperm whales hunting 2 miles below and making little echolocational sounds. Listening in on hydrophones, researcher Hal Whitehead notes that sperm whales grazing deep underwater keep a constant chorus of clicks. The jumble of clicks of a group of hunting sperms which together sound like radio static. Sperms also produce recognizable codas, which Whitehead and others understand as signature sounds, dialects, or possibly musical elements involved in whale communication. Orcas, or killer whales, also use backscatter effects from echolocation to distinguish and hunt their favorite Chinook salmon among a school of other salmon. And spinner dolphins communally forage for and trap fish utilizing collective phonation, an ability by a group to sonically navigate as well as converse in low visibility waters with broadband clicks and focus bursts of sound. So really illuminating the landscape of the ocean as a group. In an even stronger and perhaps stranger radiophonic parallel, recent research by a dentist, actually, Martin Nguia, into the nature of narwhal tusks reveals that, and you know, the narwhal is this northern sort of small cetacean whale, where for a long time they thought that it was a horn coming out of the forehead of the narwhal, kind of like the unicorn whale, but in fact turns out that the tusk is a tooth that pierces, that grows through the lip, pierces the lip, and grows to be approximately 5 feet long. And they're mainly in the male whales, but some female whales grow these tusks as well. Anyway, for a while there was this idea that the tusk was a jousting tool, the males competing for the females, jousting in the northern seas. Well, of course, it turns out to be nonsense. That, in fact, the tusk is more like an antenna, surprisingly. Unlike other teeth, its surface has open tubules connected to inner nerves. It is, in effect, a giant sense organ, basically a tooth turned inside out with the sensitive part on the outside and the solid, strong part on the inside. It's lined with 10 million nerve endings to enable the animal to detect subtle changes in temperature and pressure. This may explain why narwhals raise their tusks above water as if to sniff the air. Other research indicates that the tusk is not only a sensory probe, but may also be a transmitter or receiver of sound and even of electricity. The narwhal tusk turns out to be, as I said, a tooth turned inside out, with all its sensitive sensing faculties at the surface and the hardest mineralized dentin deposits at the center, producing a spiraling tooth that is strong and flexible, if still mysterious. So whale radio? Are we talking about whale radio? It would seem to be a form of wireless which is both intimate and tactile, and promiscuous at long range. Entirely resonant, requiring the feedback loop of resounding to be meaningful, and requiring everyone in the circuit to both send and receive. Of course, whale radio relies on mechanical, not electromagnetic waves, but remains a really potent example. Could humans develop such capacities in such social life? Or could the example of whale radio temper the ethics of the technologies that we do develop in order to communicate at a distance? Can it challenge what we think communication is for, how long it takes, and what forms it takes?
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
Tune into Radia.fm on your computer or mobile phone for more information about these weekly broadcasts from radio artists interested in new and forgotten ways of making radio. Radia.fm.